Howdy neighbors, Ron Hayes with you with another Agriculture Perspectives. Today, a special conversation held between the president of the National Association of Farm Broadcasters, Lori Boyer of Colorado, and U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue. Their fireside chat, minus the fire, held at the Western Crown Center, home of the National Association of Farm Broadcasters annual meeting for the last 46 years. We're back with their conversation in just a moment. Well, cattle producers, your next Superior Video Livestock Auction coming Thursday, November 21st, starting 8 a.m. on Dish Network, Channel 997, SLA TV, and SuperiorClickToBid.com. We'll be offering 21,000 head, 3,000 yearling steers, 1,900 yearling heifers, 14,500 weaning calves, and 1,240 calves on cows. If you'd like to know the estimated time a lot will sell or to preview the videos, go to SuperiorLivestock.com or call Superior Livestock, 1-800-422-2117.
Sonny Perdue came by his knowledge of agriculture the old-fashioned way. He was born into a farming family in Bonaire, Georgia. From childhood and through his life in business and elected office, he has experienced the industry from every possible perspective. Uniquely qualified as a former farmer, an agribusinessman, a veterinarian, a state legislature, and governor of Georgia, he became the 31st United States Secretary of Agriculture on April 25th, 2017. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Secretary Sonny Perdue.
Thank you, Laura. Good afternoon. Glad to be in Kansas City with you all. We've already had a good day. I see Congressman Marshall here, and we had a great event at our new location for ERS NIFA. A very great facility. Visited out with our current employees and the ERS NIFA people that are already out here at the Beacon facility. So we've had a very busy day, but a very productive day talking about the future of where we go and how Kansas City will contribute to that. Congressman Marshall gave great remarks about the ag tech corridor here in this area, and I think there will be a lot of synergy and symbiotic relationship between what's there and going forward. So I'm happy to be with you all again. I think it was 2 years ago. It must have been right in this same room. It looks familiar where we were here, and I think it looks like you've got some young communicators out there as well. So very good to be with you all. We need more ag communicators around the country, and I challenge young FFA students and certainly college students to be able to proudly tell the story of agriculture, because many times we get accused or blamed for many things that are not agricultural's fault. I use the proverb rather frequently that I think leads to that. When man has not enough to eat, he has one problem. When he has enough to eat, he has many problems. And I think we've created many problems in our country today because of the productivity of the American farmer and rancher. So I'm happy to be here. I look forward to our conversation and questions, and let's get going.
Okay. Broadcasters submitted questions earlier, and I'm going to get to as many as I can here in our 30 minutes. I'm going to try to hit each topic, and then if we have time, I'll come back to some of those questions, so they may not all get asked, but I'm going to do the best I can.
And it's all off the record, right?
Yeah, sure. Right. So we're just going to jump right into it. Talk to us about where we're at on trade with China, and where should our confidence level be in the agriculture industry?
Well, again, confidence level when you have to depend on China is just there. We don't know what China's response will be. I know the president and Ambassador Lighthizer and Secretary Mnuchin are working tirelessly in order to reset this relationship. Many people like to look at the last couple of years and talk about a trade war or trade disruption. This war's been going on for about 20 years, and China's been winning. And I think you look at the economic situation globally, and you can see that. But I think President Trump is committed to resetting this relationship, making sure that we're playing on a level playing field. While agriculture has enjoyed the customer standpoint of that, we also know there have been some very untoward things going on regarding technology and regarding the U.S. economy as well as the ag economy, digging up seeds and those kind of things and trying to reverse engineer using the hard work of American ingenuity and creativity and bypassing the hard work and taking it to China. So while I'm hopeful I think we have to be realistic that we don't know yet, and we won't know. The president is committed to doing this phase one deal if it's in the best interest of the United States. And there are a lot of caveats when it comes to China. I'd say the ball is in their court. The good news is the numbers that we've seen actually, if it is consummated, is going to be a tremendous windfall for agriculture. In fact, the president has asked me, can our producers produce that much? And I've committed them, when you turn the American producers loose, they're able to get it done. And if there are markets, we're going to produce to that market. In fact, I still say oftentimes, it's as a citizen of the United States of America, it's a blessing to be here where we produce more food than we can consume domestically. And trade is so important, we have to have it because we overproduce in those areas. And that's why he, again, very quickly understood last year with the market facilitation program, and again this year with the market facilitation program, why agriculturalists, producers, were going to be hardest hit because we're exporters. We contribute to the trade surplus, not the trade deficit. And so it's very important. It's a huge market. I'm hopeful. I don't know that that moves into the optimistic phase yet, but I'm hopeful that we can get something done. I do know that the President, Lighthizer, and Mnuchin would like to get something done if it's a good deal.
How many phases will there be altogether?
I don't know that. I don't know. We're talking about phase one here, which mm-hmm. does reset some serious things, but obviously other structural reforms for China that requires them to look at their overall way they do business and their economy and do more serious things. But when you talk about currency and talk about intellectual property transfers and forced transfers and agricultural purposes, those are pretty important things there themselves.
Okay. Staying on the issue of trade, will we see the passage of USMCA yet in 2019? And can we take the politics out of this and look at the human side of this and the producers in all three countries being affected by the delay?
It's a good question. If you can define imminent in Washington, D.C. for me, I can tell you the answer to that question. That's the word of the day, I think, is it will be passed. It's imminent. But as Congressman Marshall knows, imminent has different definitions in D.C. depending on who you're talking to. I'm optimistic that it will get done. It just, I think in light of everything else going on in D.C. right now, this Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, need to go home over Christmas break and say, we got this done. I do believe it'll get done this year. I think I'm glad to hear the Speaker continuing to speak favorably of it. Ambassador Lighthizer has done a marvelous job patiently addressing some of those issues. Let me just say, USMCA, we all had kind of a gasp in agriculture when the president talked about withdrawing. There was this great sucking sound there, and our mantra was, first of all, do no harm. Not only has he not done any harm, chapter by chapter, verse by verse, line by line, this is an improved relationship for agriculture, but also in the over greater economy, in manufacturing and others, for labor, for employment, for health, for environment, those types of things. When you think about this agreement, 25 years old, was created even before the internet, digital communication, data communication, then it needed to be modernized. And I think hopefully this Congress will recognize that this is something that needs to be done. I've been in Democratic and Republican districts all over the country, and I believe if it put forth today, Congressman Marshall may be able to have a better idea. I believe if it put on the floor today, it would pass both conferences, both caucuses easily.
Just a follow-up to that, during your travels and your discussions with grassroots producers, do you feel like they're getting that message? Do you feel like they're supporting it?
Oh, they have. 1,000 ag organizations supported it. You couldn't ask for better support from the agricultural community and the various groups that are affiliated with agriculture. They've been very supportive. All of the living former secretaries of agriculture have been supportive. So you couldn't get more support than this agreement has had in that way. And what else in the life today do you get that kind of unanimity about in that way? And so while we hope that the things going on in Washington that are not related to the real economy. Don't distract and get caught up into the politics of that. I'm optimistic that before these members go home for Christmas, and we'll see a deal on USMCA.
Okay. Thank you. And I know we could talk about trade a lot more, but we'll move on here and talk about something you already mentioned, market facilitation program payments.
Before we move on from trade, let's talk about China and poultry and Brazil and TRQs. Those are good announcements. I think, again, incrementally, I think what it shows is that while China has been the big elephant in the room, we're out doing other things along that way. And the president is on it, certainly from his relationship with Bolsonaro and in Brazil over those kind of things. We're pressing them on ethanol issues and that way as well. But this opening up the China market to poultry, mm-hmm. particularly for those types of poultry products that U.S. consumers don't prefer, that is a huge windfall, $1 billion potential trade with China in that area. So now I'll answer your other question.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah. Ted McKinney did talk about that yesterday at our...
Well, you've had everybody at USDA. I don't know why you want me to come out here.
We just needed to hear it again. Repetition in radio, right?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, market facilitation program payments. So there's news going on right now with the second round of payments.
There is. I think there was anxiety. And, once the first payments got announced, we're going to have the second tranche. And I'm sure after this next week when the second tranche goes out, we'll be talking about, are we going to have the third tranche? And it's an interesting question. We went to OMB, Office of Management and Budget, to the allocators of this money. The president's committed on that money. He understands that why it's needed, and he was the primary proponent of that. I think I can say pretty assuredly we would not have gotten $16 billion out of the White House without President Trump insisting that. The day after the talks broke down with the Chinese in late April, early May, he called me that next morning early, and he said, okay, what are we going to do? Bring me a program that, again, acknowledges this deal. They've backed up. They've retreated from where we had agreed, and we're not going to let them bully us into capitulating in that area. So you protect my farmers. In fact, I've told other groups, some of you may have heard me tell this story before, but in that meeting when Leah He was there and things were going well before China reneged, he had Lighthizer there sitting right across from him. Mnuchin was to his left. Leah He was to his left. I was to Lighthizer's right. And he said, guys, this was the exit interview with Leah He, the China vice premier there. And he said, sounds like things are going pretty well on the cyber issues there, and I want to encourage you all to make sure we get that done. But he pointed his finger at Mnuchin Lighthizer and says, but I want you to take care of my farmers. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of gives you a little bit. When the president points his finger at you and tells you to take care of somebody, that's how this all got done. It wouldn't have gotten done without him. But again, we are delighted that OMB, again, released the allocation of the second tranche. I guess the question is, and maybe the unasked question is, if we get a trade deal there, what is the expectation from the producer community over that, and what's the expectation from 2020? I personally don't want us to get entitled for other market facilitation payments. I think farmers said from the very beginning, and I believe them, they'd rather have trade than aid, and I'm hoping we get trade. So I'm hoping we get a trade deal that moves the markets in a very positive way.
So there was a question on these MFP payments, it being a signal that phase one of the China trade deal may not happen. But based on what you've already talked about with China, it sounds like these are completely separate things going on and not relying on each other.
Well, they are currently. I mean, the future is, it's like Yogi Berra said, the future's all ahead of us. We don't know. But anyway, the y'all didn't know who Yogi Berra was, right? Okay. The fact is, as kind of what I said earlier, if we get a major trade deal, and when I'm talking about a major trade deal, the purchase quantities are double what they've ever bought before. Now, the proof's in the pudding. We want to see the contracts. We want to see the orders here, not just the commitment. But if we have China buying twice as much as they've ever bought before, that ought to move the markets. That ought to move the market significantly.
Sure. Yeah.
And farmers, while they have benefited and, you know, needed the market facilitation program, they really would rather have trade than aid. And to some degree, the dichotomy of the emotions out there are, farmers would rather have the money from the scales in the mailbox. And that's why it's been sort of unfulfilling to some degree of having to rely on those market facilitation programs. But we don't want to have to rely on them permanently. I'm not encouraging anyone to expect a 2020 payment.
There have reportedly been some instances of farmers who still haven't received the first round. Can you explain why there are any difficulties going and getting these payments to those who are awaiting them?
No, I can't. I'm not aware of that. But if those people would contact us directly over, you mean the first round of market facilitation programs?
Mm-hmm.
Unless there's some certification issue at the county level, I do not know why that would occur, and I'm not familiar with those having happened. But if they would alert our people, I'm not aware of anything from Undersecretary Northey or Jamie Clover Adams that's going on. Frankly, what I've heard is pretty smooth out there on that, and I want to congratulate again our FPAC people for really working on that. You've had two disasters in a row, two market facilitation as a program in a row, and I think they've done yeoman's work to get that done as smoothly as they have and on time in that way. So I would encourage you all, if you have people that you know of that have not received the first tranche of market facilitation, we'll dig down and find out what that is.
Okay. There have been some complaints from Midwest farmers that a higher amount of the MFP payments are going to farmers in other parts of the country, rather to those in the Midwest areas hit by adverse weather and a trade war. Will there be any adjustments to how those payments are being handled going forward?
Sure. The answer to your last question is no, and I do want to correct the record. It's been interesting. One of our members of Congress on the Senate side had this 10-page report where she advocated that. What the deal is, it's interesting, of the five southeastern states that she referenced, both Illinois and Iowa individually had more money than those five southeastern states combined in that area.
Wow.
So Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, they're in the top five as far as the money goes out. So this is nothing more than a political conversation trying to, again, bash administration. And the facts are there. They're very clear. One of the reasons you had higher county rates in that was you have higher valued rates, value crop rates like cotton and peanuts that are grown in those southeastern states rather than corn and beans on a per-acre basis. And that was the influence of the county rates that were commuted. But you can't conflate county rates with the dollars that have gone out. The dollars have been overwhelmingly to our best production area, which is the Midwest and upper Midwest.
Okay. Is there anything else that we should know about MFP that you would like us to get to our audiences?
Again, I hear good things from the farming community out there. You said farmers were complaining. Really, I haven't heard farmers complain aside from this report that was put out of the Senate. So I think our farmers are pretty happy with I met with the Fed this morning over at the Kansas City Fed, which is sort of the ag Fed for the country. And I met with lenders across the country. I can tell you the lenders are very happy about that, and they're very pleased. While farmers are less fulfilled about money coming from the mailbox than they are the scales, the lenders don't care where the money comes from. So they're glad to have the repayment of those loans out there, and I'm happy that our farmers will be able to survive. No one ever thought, it's just like a insurance, when you have crop insurance or anything else, you never feel like you're made whole, but again, it will allow people to continue to go forward.
You have this radio thing down because you segue right into my next topic.
All right.
Which is the farm economy.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this for a little while. The first question I have here is, we have a lot of farmers in Iowa and throughout the Corn Belt who are very stressed about rising debt and lack of income. There are farmers who want trade, not, well, you've already mentioned this, trade, not aid. Can you speak to what USDA is going to do to help these farmers before it's too late?
Well, I think what we're doing is what's helping here. $28 billion is pretty good help in the farm economy. If you really look at the numbers rather than emotional conversation, is farm income is going to be up this year. Why is it up? It's going to be up primarily because of transfer payments, both crop insurance and market facilitation programs. So while we talk about things that are really bad, there is a lot of stress out there. There's emotional stress. Mm-hmm. I would say economically, the stress is more about working capital diminishment. There's no doubt that working capital has gone down and cash is king, so you don't have as much in the checkbook to write for things that you need to pay for. And but we're coming off career highs from, you know, 2009 to 2012 and 13. Those were career highs for most farmers in that area. And good production and good prices, some of the best we'd ever seen. And so this market's been shrinking down price-wise since 2012. So we've had this trade war for a couple of years, and a lot of people like to use that as a reason or excuse. Mm-hmm. But these prices have been going down. There's been economic stress. Why? Because we're so dadgum productive. And farmers in this country, with yields continuing to go up, are just overproducers. That's why we got to get out here and find more people other than China to buy. India, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Thailand, Vietnam, all those. India is going to have just as many people as China. They've been a tough nut to crack regarding exports, but Ted McKinney's been there two or three times. President's talking to President Modi over there. Lighthizer's on it. I'm hoping we can continue to kind of crack that nut that India is, so and develop big markets otherwise.
What are your forecasters telling you as far as looking short-term and long-term at what our commodity prices are going to look like? I know we have more bankruptcies than we've seen since 2011. What are they telling you?
You know, bankruptcies, let's talk about that for a second. I was asked a question this morning earlier at the television station about soaring bankruptcies. You know, if you start with two and you go to three, that's a 50% increase. The good news is we're not in the 80s. While we are seeing more bankruptcies, the overall number is still relatively small. And if there are bankruptcies, guess who's buying that property? Their neighbors and other farmers. These are not Wall Street investors coming out here and buying this land. That's why I went to the Fed this morning to talk about, you know, what's actually happening on the ground out here. And we had a land manager there that manages, I think, several thousand farms for absentee owners there. And he was telling us the fact that land rents are fairly stable, which is a good barometer. Land prices are fairly stable. And whenever you see land transferred, it's the farmer next door that really wants it. And he had a list of people wanting to rent land, cash rent land, of the properties that they own. So I think the real economic stress is really working capital. It's that checkbook. And it worries us when we get low on cash. And I understand that. That is economic stress. But farmers, many of them 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, weren't having to borrow any operating money. And then you have to borrow, and that's a change that really reflects the psychology and the emotion. It makes you feel like you're doing a lot worse than you are. So I think we bottomed out. If we can get a trade deal done, I'm telling you, with China on the kind of numbers we're talking about, I mean, I might want to go back to farming, you know.
But your economic forecasters, based on what they know now, what are they telling you for next year, possibly even the next couple of years?
Well, we put economic forecast out, but forecasting economics and agriculture is like forecasting the weather. You know, is it going to rain next week or not? You know, some say yes, some say no, and there. So I think we're in the survival mode from a perspective of people are able to most people are able to do it again next year. But I think from a pricing perspective, I believe we're in a trough and we're coming to, you know, I think we're already seeing some signs of coming out of that. We see it in milk prices where dairies had been the most stressed of virtually any ag sector. We're seeing some there. What Congressman Marshall and his colleagues did with the farm bill over dairies is going to be extremely helpful that way. The insurance product, the price protection product, and all that, is, and the Farm Bureau RMA product, the crop insurance program, is going to be very helpful. I think we're going to see that. We just need to see worldwide demand. We have had 4 or 5 years of global production without almost any kind of problems anywhere. And that leads to more than we can consume, which lowers price. It's economics 101. And that's not going to continue forever. Just like those 5 years from 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 weren't going to last forever, these aren't going to last forever. I'm a believer. I think this too shall pass.
Okay. Before we move on to the next topic, anything else you want to follow up with regard to the farm economy or anything we should be asking you?
We want to recognize it's been stressful. I think most of that stress, again, I'll say it again, I think it's come from diminishing, depleting working capital, which makes us feel anxious and makes us feel not certain for the future. If you got a lot of money in the bank, you know you can go next year. Some of these farmers have been living out of their cash flow or out of their liquidity for the next year. They're not able to do that any longer. That makes you feel anxious.
Yeah.
And so I think we've bottomed out. And again, if these trade deals come about again, I think we're in for a great ride.
Okay. I know when you first came into the room, you and your crew had just toured your new facility here in Kansas City. Yep. So let's talk a little bit about that. I'll start off with this two-part question. First impressions of the new facility, and does USDA have plans to expedite the hiring process to fill existing vacancies at the agency, or will you need to go through a traditional hiring process?
Sure. Good questions. First of all, I want to compliment the Kansas City region. While the location is in Kansas City, Missouri, this metropolitan, this community, both states, both Governor Parsons, Governor Kelly, all of their teams, as well as the economic developers on both sides, looked at this as a joint effort, and they did that way. Having been a governor, we competed all along for relocations and jobs, but this was a great unified effort, and I think it was analytical. It was competitive, 136 expressions of interest from all over the county, all over the country. The final three were all three locations, Indianapolis, Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, and Kansas City. So there was some good competition. And I told Governor Parsons when I came here, they earned it. And having been to the facility this morning, I'm even more impressed with where we are locating. This is Class A space that will help Kansas City downtown, again, with secure federal jobs for a period of time, help the revitalization. So it is a win-win situation as far as I'm concerned. And these people are going to enjoy a quality of life that I believe they would not have enjoyed elsewhere in that regard. We're already having a lot of people excited about the commute times and where the space is going to be and the livability, the housing costs, the schools, all those kind of things that people out in this area already know about. But coming from D.C., it's like the, you know, Lewis and Clark expedition. What are we going to see across the river, you know? But there, you know, my expectation is that in 3 years there would be more angst and gnashing of teeth trying to get the guys to go back to D.C. rather than getting them here. So they're excited about it. Our people at the Beacon Center have been very, very welcoming and open hospitality, showed them where all the great barbecue joints were and that kind of thing.
That's
so that is important. But it's really good. The space is great. It looks almost new, really. And it's in a wonderful location downtown. Hiring. It's all about people. We've already had a career expo last week. Over 400 people showed up. And both we were, I think, exceeded expectations regarding the quantity and the quality of people interested in that. When you got within a three-hour drive, all these land-grant colleges, and as I said, it's going to be a synergistic relationship with this ag core that's already created out here, and this facility as well, in Bath, and all those kind of things that will help to build the critical mass of agriculture here. So we posted 107 jobs thus far, and my HR person tells me we've had 6,000 applications. And
wow.
We do have direct hiring authority. which will expedite. Now, onboarding federal employees is a frustrating, torturous experience ordinarily. And I'm talking to Congressman Marshall about that. But they were generous enough to give us direct hiring authority about that. And we're going to take advantage of that, get these people onboarded as quickly as possible.
Remind me, how many total jobs will be relocated?
It'll be between 600 and 700, mm-hmm. between permanent federal employees, contractors, and interns coming and going. Mm-hmm.
And I know there's been, in general, some pushback on that. You know, how have you handled some of those comments?
I wouldn't call it general pushback. I'd just call it people being mad. And I never realized that there'd be, hey, Senator Blunt back there, we've talked about some of the naysayers, but I think, as I said over at the facility, I'm even more convinced today, having seen the facility, this is the right place at the right time with the right people and the right jobs. And so I really haven't let it bother me. We had good reasons to come here. And once again, I think in 2 or 3 years, once this is all settled down, people get in that space, people are going to say, well, why didn't you do that earlier?
Okay. Anything else you want to mention about that before we move on?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I have one question about ethanol. It's kind of a long question.
Okay. I got a long answer.
During a late October cabinet, you talked about the president delivering on his promises about making E15 available year-round.
Right.
You commented that the president had balanced up the small refinery waivers with farmers and the RFS. You also said once farmers fully understand what the president has done, they'll understand what you have done. The farmers will be fine as the program has been implemented. Several ag groups have been critical of the proposed rules concerning SREs and the ability to fulfill the 15 billion gallon RFS requirement. The question to you today is, what are farm groups and farmers not understanding specifically as it relates to the EPA's proposed rules that were released about a month ago?
First of all, I think all of this is based on a serious distrust with EPA, based on small refinery waivers issued earlier. But I want to put it really simple. The president expects, I expect, and we have communicated to Andrew Wheeler and the EPA that 15 billion gallons equals 15 billion gallons. That's the net. I've told the administrator, I don't know what's in that black box of small refinery waivers, and I don't really care how many you issue, as long as the number top of the line minus those small refinery waivers equals 15 billion gallons. Now, the problem is, based on history and based on the diminishment of the RFS gallons, RVO gallons in the last 3 years, I can understand the lack of trust. But I can tell you, that's what the president is expecting, is 15 billion gallons equaling 15 billion gallons. And while there was some uproar about the way the rules were done, that's my direct understanding with Andrew Wheeler. It's his direct understanding of the president and my expectation of that. And I think once we get there and prove that, then people will understand what the president's commitment was. Regarding the E15 year-round, the best opportunity we have for domestic consumption is building that infrastructure out here to use E15 in many places across the country. We've got to get that infrastructure down there. The president's willing to help with that if we can bring a plan together that makes sense about helping and incentivizing infrastructure where a person can pull up to the pump and see E15 there without those skull and crossbone signs out there that says this has caused cancer and that kind of stuff, then if a consumer has a choice to pick in an easily available, just like E10, an 88 octane versus an 87 octane with a possibly 3 to 5 cent price advantage, I think they're going to do it. Consumers are smart. They know what they want and the better air quality and those kind of things. So we just got to make it available. That's a 50% growth in demand if we can grow from E10 to E15. Now, we're not going to do it overnight, but we've got to get on with it, and that's the best opportunity we have. Most of the macroeconomic issues we've had with ethanol this year have been because of lower exports, not small refinery waivers. And I'll say that. I've got the facts to prove it. I know that emotionally people want to talk about, you got to have something to blame in farming. I'm forever, you know, if you're a farmer, you just got to have something to blame.
I have time for one more question, it sounds like. And hopefully, I'm going to ask this generally, and hopefully it answers both these questions. Where do you think we're headed with industrial hemp in this country and the development of this product?
Who knows? There's been more excitement about this product. I just hope we can develop the uses for industrial hemp. I don't believe there's enough CBD oil demand out there to do what American farmers can do if all that grows. We've got to have other industrial uses using the fiber in many, many ways other than just stall fodder, that kind of thing. We've got to be able to invent that and find out how we use this crop and how we use all of the crop, not just the low 0.3 THC for other types of things, but how do we use the whole crop that way? If we can, it could be a great deal. I'm afraid there's a little bit of over expectation right now about that, and I want to caution people to make sure they've got a place to sell their hemp. It's kind of interesting. I've never seen anything get this kind of attention before without a determined market that way. So we've issued the rules and regulations. States have to sync up with that. But this is a new crop, an unusual crop, and it has a cousin that's illegal in many places. And the look and the feel of that is much the same. You've already seen some news reports recently about confiscation of the legal and the illegal crops that way. So we have to work through this. Farmers need to be, they need to do a lot of research and a lot of study about what they're going to do with that crop before they go to the expense, a significant expense of putting in several acres themselves.
Secretary Perdue, thank you so much for being at our convention.
Thank you, Laura.
For joining us today. We're out of time for our questions, but we've sure enjoyed having you. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks.
USDA Secretary Sunny Perdue.
Thank you.